This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Connection is the greatest strength in the fight against suicide. Together, we can encourage those who are struggling to seek help and to know they're not alone. For free resources or to learn how you can get involved in their mission, visit afsp.org.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around because later in the episode, we'll break down today's biggest stories in the Chicago area. But first, when someone picks up the phone to call 911 during a mental health crisis, who shows up can make all the difference. Since 2021, a Chicago program's been deploying social workers instead of law enforcement to nonviolent mental health incidents. And now it's expanding to serve all of Chicago. So what does that expansion actually mean for residents, emergency response times, and mental health care in this city, especially in a moment of crisis? In this episode of The Pod, we're going to check in with a pair of folks involved with that city program. At the table was Arturo Carrillo, who's a deputy mayor of Health and Human Services for the City of Chicago, and Tiffany Patton Burnside, who's a licensed social worker and senior director of crisis services for the Crisis Assistance Response and Engagement Program. I started with a question for both guests. What's the importance of having mental health professionals rather than police respond to these calls? Tiffany went first.
It's important because it's a change to the system. It's a change that has been much needed. It's a change that the people have been asking for in this instance where we have individuals who are, you know, having their worst days, having someone who can show up with a trauma-informed response, with compassion and care, I think will go miles in saving the lives. And that is the goal of the health department, is ensuring that we decrease the life expectancy gaps between African-Americans and others in America, in Chicago. So within that context, the care team shows up with that goal in mind.
And what comes to mind for you, Arturo, you know, of having somebody like Tiffany from the CARE program responding to a scene like this versus a cop?
Yeah, we want to get the right responder to the calls that need this sort of support. You know, and having trained professionals, licensed clinical social workers, EMTs, be able to assess and support the individual not only in that moment of crisis, but to provide the follow-up care that's necessary is absolutely the way to have a public health strategy to address a variety of crises.
Now, this program, as I mentioned, has been around for 5 years. It launched in 2021. Any successes that you want to share with us, Tiffany, since this pilot was launched?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. The first success is having a new program built within the infrastructure of the city's public safety and public health departments. That is phenomenal and huge. And having those two departments be able to work together to be able to lift this program up. I mean, we've had countless successes with individuals that we have supported over these years as well.
Mm. Tell me more about the merge of the two departments. What does that help?
First, there's communication gaps that have been filled between the two departments. So that's always helpful when you can have two commissioners sitting in the same space looking at a specific problem within the city that has been identified by all parties involved. People who are suffering from in mental health crisis, who are lacking alternatives other than hospitals and jails. Mm-hmm. Now we were able to create, you know, a system by which we can offer different types of supports, even supports that may allow a person to stay within their home and not be taken to these two options. But the system in and of itself, the two organizations and agencies being able to communicate and work together to build something great that'll help the city
right.
and its residents has just been phenomenal.
And you said you're hearing from people who you've actually helped?
Oh, yeah.
What are they saying?
I mean, I personally work on the van, so I do the work as well. I'm not just the supervisor. I go outside, too. But within that context, we have been able to help families reunite. One of my teams, and this is the most amazing thing that has, one of the most amazing things that we've heard so far, the teams were just out canvassing, and they found a young lady who had been missing for 10 years.
Wow.
And we're able to return her back to her family, get her help, support, reunite a family.
10 years missing.
10 years missing.
Incredible.
And she just so happened to find her. She flagged them down and they, you know, offered the support, did the assessments. She pointed out where her family was. They took her there. They took her home.
That's incredible. Arturo, I mean, when you hear things like this, this is clearly a long time coming to expand this and start offering it in all parts of the city.
Absolutely. People from throughout all of Chicago have advocated for this. And of course, our mayor has been committed to making this a citywide initiative. So we're absolutely excited to take the lessons we've learned through this pilot phase and now, again, scale it up citywide.
Like, imagine, you know, being able to multiply and add many more stories like the one Tiffany just told.
Absolutely.
So walk us through, Tiffany, what currently happens when someone calls 911. And it's for a mental health crisis, nonviolent. We got to make sure that that's clear, right? Mm-hmm. There's no weapon present.
Mm-hmm. That is correct.
How do they get connected to the care team? And tell me more about situations that you don't respond to.
Yeah. So what you can expect when a care team arrives is, as you've mentioned, an ENT and a licensed clinician who will offer de-escalation, a trauma-informed response, say care and support. They do a medical triage. They do a behavior health assessment, just and a needs assessment to determine what all is going on. Because we want an accurate picture of the individual in crisis, recognizing that individuals do not go into behavior health crisis in a vacuum. There may be several layers of things that have happened that compounded, and now this person is in need of support, and they call 911. And in calling 911, that individual's call will be screened to ensure that they don't have any active weapons, they don't have any active acts of physical aggression, and then the care team is sent out.
And
you see the big blue Divvy van with a large care logo on the side. So you know when that team shows up,
they're coming. You
cannot miss us. They're coming with resources and support and help. Even to the point where on the van, we have resources. We have food. We have water. We have blankets. We live in Chicago. We have all seasons in one day. We have clothes on that van, shoes, depending on what you need.
Oh, wow.
We have the support right there to meet your immediate need. And that will help us, you know, work with you and build trust and develop trust to be able to get you to that next point and get you out of that crisis state.
And you help de-escalate.
Yes.
If need be.
Yes, ma'am.
Right. So, Arturo, does someone have the option of requesting that police or fire personnel be dispatched alongside someone from the care team?
Yes, that's absolutely what we're working towards. We want to make sure that when people call 911, this option is readily available. They'll be screened. One of the big announcements with this expansion is that we're also expanding the types of calls that can receive care support to now include social emotional distress. As Tiffany mentioned, right, there's a lot of needs that go beyond what a mental illness crisis looks like. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of that is connected to the lack of immediate resources and going through a very difficult moment. So providing that support is going to be part of this broader scope now.
Yeah. So tell me what you say to people who might be concerned that this program and its approach to public safety, right, with in some cases no police officers on scene. Maybe they say, well, that makes us less safe. That makes the city less safe.
You know, the data doesn't show that. I mean, we've seen and researched these models throughout the country. There's been no incidents nationwide that have caused that sort of concern based on any experience that alternative crisis responders nationwide have experienced. So again, it's very safe. It's very much the best option for individuals in those moments of high need.
So when are you hoping to launch this citywide, Arturo?
This is a rolling start. So we're in the active moment of expansion.
How close are we?
Yeah, we're really close. We're really close. As you can imagine, there's a lot of levers and dials to tweak as we're going citywide. But this is an active rollout. We are absolutely, again, learning from the lessons of the experience that we had in the 6 police districts where this was piloted.
Yeah.
To then, again, apply those lessons as now we have to make sure that this is functional throughout every corner of the city.
And where's the funding coming from?
So this is also a great announcement, right? Mayor Brandon Johnson made sure to shift this money into the corporate budget to make it part of our permanent budget item that we will continue to build as the years progress. Again, there's a commitment to make sure that this is expanded and permanent, be part of the first responder ecosystem here in the city.
Yeah, so this sounds to me like it, you know, the intention here is for it to be here to stay.
Yes, absolutely.
No longer a pilot.
Absolutely.
Right? Tiffany, how are you preparing to expand, right, to serve all of Chicago's 22 police districts? Because that's also not an easy feat, I don't think.
It is definitely not. I would be remiss if I did not mention how diverse our city is. And with that diversity comes quite a few differences and different styles of approach. What we have done over the course of the 5 years that we have been in and out of pilot is we've done some landscape analysis through our 911 data to determine like the behavioral health calls for service. What are the root causes of those calls? So in some police districts, we found that those individuals calling 911 for behavioral health support were individuals calling for someone who was on autism spectrum disorder or have developmental delays. So that means we re-round on training to ensure that the staff is trained up to be able to support those individuals.
Oh, okay.
We found that, you know, in some communities, there are more families that live in the community, and we're responding to families as opposed to individuals in crisis. So we're there to now not only work with that individual who may be the one with identified as having a behavioral health problem or behavioral health symptoms, but also the family ecosystem and offering them support as well so that they will be better able to serve and support their loved one. Mm. So those type of data analysis that we have done over this time has allowed for us to tailor our training as such. So now we have our cultural humility trainings include working with individuals who have different types of diagnoses that you may see in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So the teams are trained to work with individuals with certain diagnoses, but when you're in crisis, those symptoms may heighten. So working with those, we've also increased our training and working with different intersectionalities. So we have training with LGBTQ. We have training for individuals who are deaf or hard of hearing. We have training for individuals who are from different cultures.
Oh, okay.
So we want to make sure that we have respectful interactions with all of these people. And what does a person in crisis with all of these intersections look like?
Yeah, being able to identify that the initial point is key.
Mm-hmm. So we've been staffing up and training in an effort to make sure that we're offering culturally competent trauma-informed responses to these individuals that we can support just knowing what they could be going through.
Yeah, I mean, at current staffing levels, just so we're clear, are Chicago's 911 call centers prepared to dispatch care to all parts of the city?
Yeah, we'll be rolling with 8 vans citywide, so we'll be dividing those up north and south.
Nice.
You know, one of the things that we also want to highlight here is, as Tiffany mentioned, right, responding to a moment of crisis is essential. We also want to prevent further crises, right? So we want to make sure that the aftercare is being provided to, again, provide the follow-up support upon initial contact. We also want to prevent crises from happening. There is going to be a pathway now through an email address where people can request care for non-emergency situations. And again, to engage with people before the crisis occurs as well, right? Mm-hmm. So we have an email address, careprogram@cityofchicago.org. And that would be the way for people to get, again, response within 72 hours, again, for non-emergency situations. But again, really intentionally making sure that we can be proactive in supporting people.
And that was careprogram@cityofchicago.org.
Correct.
So the care team just went through a round of hiring, I understand, Tiffany. You've got another round coming in another month or so. Mm-hmm. And the current hours of operation, they're a bit limited from what I understand, right? It's just kind of like 10 to 4,
yes.
10 to 4:30.
So 10 to 4:30. So those are our pilot hours. And as Arturo mentioned, that we are doing like this rolling expansion. So that's the first stage. Our hours increase by an hour. So we're trying to do the best that we can with the system that is currently set up. And as we move towards expanding our hours and adding another shift, then we'll be, you know, adding more time to it as time goes on.
Right.
So with the goal of being 20 some odd hours a day, 7 days a week, I have to, that's more in Dr. Carrillo's wheelhouse in explaining or planning for that
part. Yeah. Anything to add?
Yeah, you know, we'll be monitoring. We will be tracking data and making sure that, again, as the calls come in, we'll be able to assess and reassess continually as we roll this out.
I asked you earlier about, you know, successes thus far in the last 5 years of doing this sort of under the pilot umbrella. looking ahead, right, and just sort of knowing what the goals are and where the levels that you want to reach, I'd love to hear from you both. What would success look like a year or two from now with this new expanded offering? Arturo?
You know, being a national leader, you know, we've learned from many of the municipalities, and one of the things that we've seen is often limited by other response teams is where to connect people, right, for the follow-up care. And so Chicago is in a very unique position in that we have now, thanks to Mayor Brandon Johnson, reopening two additional public mental health centers, a total of 7 public mental health centers that could be part of this infrastructure, right? My vision for this and commitment to making sure Chicago is well-resourced in every neighborhood is building on that public infrastructure and connecting with our nonprofit partners to make sure that there's a robust system of follow-up care to ensure that people who are engaging with care will then ultimately get the follow-up and continued support that they need. Again, we want to make sure Chicago is the healthiest city, and addressing the life expectancy gap requires this sort of mental health approach as well.
Yeah. How are you measuring effectiveness from here on out, Tiffany?
I have a different approach. I measure effectiveness by how this message is carried out and how we utilize the systems that are being put in place in an effort to ensure that people know that this program exists, that, you know, word of mouth in Chicago is pretty big. We love to talk about our things. So
yes.
How many people request us. So I'm looking at that type of data from our 911 partners, how many emails come into the care program email address. I'll be looking at that data, but also, how many lives have we touched? So while we are, as an ecosystem, you know, someone to call, someplace, someone to respond, and someplace to take people, how is that system also being built out as we move along? Additionally, you know, my team, we have 4 case managers who have been very successful with individuals as well. So post-crisis, we offer a minimum of 30 days of case management to the individuals in crisis to ensure that they don't keep cycling through the system. But within that, we've had successes. We've housed 11 people, which in a city that in a time where housing is under attack by the federal government and those funds are under attack,
yeah,
we have been able to successfully work with individuals who are unhoused but were in crisis to get them to a point of stability and housed. I'm looking at the future, the big picture of how an individual's life is impacted by the work that we have done and the interventions and methods.
Of course, you're on the ground, right? Yeah. You have a very different lens. And all that leads me to is a final question for Arturo. I mean, is this program going to live on beyond Mayor Johnson's term?
Absolutely. Mayor Johnson has been committed to making this part of this corporate budget because, again, it deserves that sort of investment. And, again, where and how we place our public dollars is where we place our values.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Time now for a look at the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois. At the table to help me break them down, Alex Degman, WBEZ reporter and anchor, Courtney Kippers, WBEZ arts and culture reporter, and Matt Moore, Chicago Sun-Times newsletter reporter. Parking in Chicago, it's everyone's favorite topic, isn't it? Well, maybe not, but that is where we kick things off. The city's very unpopular parking meter deal could be sold. Here's Alex with the details.
It's looking like there is a tentative deal between Chicago Parking Meters LLC and a New York-based firm called Stone Peak Partners. Now, if I remember right, there are about 57 years left on this 75-meter parking deal that former Mayor Daley signed in 2008.
Sheesh.
And this would basically mean, if this goes through, that Stone Peak would be collecting the profits and overseeing everything for the rest of that term or until it gets sold again.
Yeah.
The only catch here is that City Council still has to approve it. So, yes, there is a tentative deal, but aldermen are still going to have a say, and they're still going to look at it and be like, okay, what else can we get out of this? So that's sitting there now, and we're just going to follow that as that goes through. And we don't know right now how much this is going to be worth.
The 75-year deal arranged by what Mayor Richard M. Daley back in 08, I mean, it's to sell, 36,000 parking meters to this group of investors that you talked about. It was $1.5 billion?
Yeah, it was something like that.
Was the deal?
Yeah, and
We've already made that back and more, haven't we?
Well, I mean, hindsight, you know what they say about that. But if you remember, Mayor Johnson was thinking about buying it back earlier in January.
That's right.
The Sun-Times was reporting that would have been worth about $3 billion at that time. So he said, no, we're not going to do that. Mm. And here we are.
So the City Council has to approve this deal. And now, again, are we likely to see that happen? What do you think?
Well, given that I know very little about the city, my expertise is really in state government. It really depends on who has the political will to get this done, who wants what, and ultimately what's going to be. I mean, is there any way that this could be made better for the city? That's what they're going to have to try to decide.
Yeah. Well, Matt, speaking of the state, let's pivot to our governor just a bit here, because another story that we're following is Governor Pritzker having some criticism for Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson yesterday. What's this all about?
Yeah. So basically at an unrelated press conference yesterday, Governor Pritzker, he said that Mayor Brandon Johnson essentially has no plan to keep the Bears in Chicago. And, he kind of had this kind of pointed criticism about the mayor and his Governor Pritzker sees is his tendency to show up toward the end of the legislative session and then what he called typical and then come in with a list of demands rather than follow what Pritzker's preferred process of just maybe proposing some things earlier in the year as the budget is being developed. And it's all pretty consequential stuff.
Well, let's hear from you on the back end. First, I want to hear this in Pritzker's words.
I know that the mayor has no plan. He has come up with no plan at all about how the Bears would end up in the city of Chicago. So that's problematic. I'd love them to be in the city, but we are 3 years in now and he still has no plan.
So Matt, I mean, is this really all on Mayor Johnson, you think?
I think it's to my understanding, the way that I see it is, you know, the Bears are going to do what they want to do, right?
Yeah.
And right now they kind of have, it's two options. A source told the Sun-Times that basically when the Bears, go in for this NFL quarterly meeting today, they're going to talk about the two options they have on the table. And one is Arlington Heights, which we've, talked about at length. And then, of course, there's the site at Hammond, Indiana. And the site at Hammond, Indiana, it's interesting to me because it's in my mind, it's kind of a problematic site. That I was thinking about what my colleague Mitchell Armantrout reported the other day about the Hammond site. It's on the Lost Marsh Golf Course. It's built on like an old industrial dump near an oil refinery. That's situated near a Superfund site. And that's, just a toxin-tainted soil.
Yeah, it sounds problematic.
But at the same time, there's some benefits there for the Bears as far as they get to build that dream dome, right? So I don't know. It really depends on what the owners want to do.
Yeah. I'm not so sure. Chicago is not in the mix of either of those options.
That's right.
At the end of the day.
And it's not, as my colleague friend Spielman pointed out, it's not super fair of Pritzker to say that Johnson didn't have a plan. I think it was a couple years ago. There was this big, press conference where Mayor Brandon Johnson was there with president of the Bears, and Pritzker was noticeably absent, but it was this huge, publicly funded dream stadium, still on the lakefront, just kind of next to the Bears stadium, or pardon me, Soldier Field. So, but it's interesting, and I've asked I write the Sun-Times morning newsletter, and I've asked in a couple different ways readers, what would you want to see done with Soldier Field?
What did they tell you?
It's interesting. A lot of people, now this was before McDonald's Stadium by the lake.
Yeah.
But people wanted to see it, you know, fully devoted to soccer. So that's kind of out the door. And then one pie in the sky idea was someone was like, wouldn't it be great to reinvigorate White Sox fandom and just put it right there by the lake? But I like the ambition. So.
Oh, interesting. Oh. Well, Courtney, let's get you in here because it looks like a Chicago museum. It's in the hot water. They may have violated labor law. What's going on?
Yeah, that's right. A new complaint alleges that the Chicago History Museum violated federal labor laws when management disciplined and fired employees last year after they unionized. And this is all spelled out in a new formal complaint against the museum from the National Labor Relations Board.
So what kind of retaliation is the museum accused of carrying out towards the employees?
Yeah, after employees at the museum voted to unionize in April of 2025, the museum's then head of HR fired four employees, disciplined four others, and threatened all employees with termination because of the union effort. This is all according to that Labor Relations Board complaint. And then later, more employees were also laid off, and others had their jobs cut from full-time to part-time. And I should say also, Sasha, the History Museum workers are part of a wave of cultural workers who have unionized in recent years.
Yeah, this is a much broader movement.
Yeah, we've talked about this a lot. We have seen workers really now at most major cultural institutions in our city form unions in recent years. So the workers at the History Museum certainly are not alone in this effort.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of unionizing, Matt, some Chicago nurses are looking to organize. What's the story there?
So Rush University Medical Center, you know, near West Side, the nurses there secured enough votes in favor of being represented by the National Nurses Organizing Committee. That's an affiliate of the larger National Nurses United. So the final count saw 77% vote in support. In total, that's like 1,190 nurses voted to form a union, 350 voted against doing so. And so that union is going to, it's expected to include about 2,000 nurses at Rush University Medical Center. And
what are they looking for?
So basically what they want is staffing. They want more nurses for patients, and they want protections for nurses, which they say that'll create a safer environment for not only them, but for the patients. And they also want the nurses to be, you know, represented, have a voice, have a seat at the table. And something that I think was kind of notable here is a photojournalist at the Sun-Times, Candace Dane Chambers, she captured the moment that at the Billy Goat, you know, on the near West Side by the United Center, there was a watch party there with the nurses, and just seeing that moment when they realized that they had the votes, it looked like a range of emotions, you know, mostly joy. Some people were visibly emotional. My colleague, Elvia Melo-Gones, she reported that, you know, some people were thinking about, like, senior nurses. This was, like, a long time coming, and this effort to unionize. And other people, they were doing shots. They were they were thrilled, you know?
So you celebrate how you want to celebrate.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, they were tossing them back.
Yeah.
So.
Alex, a Chicago alder is suing the federal government. Which alder and for what?
Well, this is Alderperson Jessie Fuentes, and she is seeking $100,000 in damages over the incident at Humboldt Park Health in October. Mm-hmm. She says that she went to that hospital because she was trying to advocate for a patient who was there in ICE custody. But video shows that when she got there, she was asking federal agents, you know, do you have a judicial warrant? Are you allowed to be here? And she was getting shoved, and eventually she was placed in handcuffs. And DHS says that she wasn't actually arrested, but she was eventually let out of handcuffs. But she says that this whole thing, you know, federal officials need to be held accountable for that because that's not supposed to happen.
Let's hear a little bit of that incident that you're referring to, Alex.
He has constitutional rights. Do you have a sign?
No, you need to leave.
For me.
Turn around. You're cheating. Turn around and leave.
He's under arrest.
I'm going to arrest
under
you.
Arrest.
You are going to be placed under arrest.
So turn around. Do you have a sign?
You need to leave. For me.
Do we have any response yet from the federal government in regards to the suit?
So we don't, I don't know if it's to the if it's to the lawsuit itself, but a DHS spokesperson did issue a statement. It's rather lengthy, but you know, saying things like patrol vehicles were blocked in by agitators, vehicles were being boxed in after repeated verbal lawful commands. There were things that happened. So it's a lengthy statement. So they have responded, but Jessie Fuentes, for her part, says essentially, I really don't care about the money. I just want to make sure that that this is that this actually gets taken to court and these folks are held accountable if they need to be.
Here's Fuentes saying just that on Fox 32.
This is an opportunity to show constituents across the city of Chicago that we have a justice system and a legal system that we can utilize to hold these federal agents accountable. We look forward to what that process looks like to ensure that we are showing constituents that we don't have to fold into the fear and that justice and accountability is possible in this moment.
Be interesting to see how this one turns out.
Absolutely.
What other stories are you following, Alex?
So there are some consumer watchdog groups that are kind of going after Nicor Gas for asking for a $220 million rate hike this year after they just got one last year of about, I think, $168 million. Nicor says that they still have some infrastructure work that they need to do and they need to spread that out, and a law allows them to do that. But what the consumer groups are saying is, well, actually, you've done all that infrastructure work. You've replaced all of the pipes that you need to replace based on that state law. And now it just kind of seems like it just kind of seems like this isn't necessary.
So they're
looking to have the Illinois Commerce Commission at least dial it back or something.
Yeah. Courtney, are you a Sufjan Stevens fan?
You know that I am, Sasha. So certainly.
I hear that there's some good news on that front.
There is good news. Illinois is returning. This is the Tony Award-winning show based on the 2005 Sufjan Stevens album, Illinois. And the stage adaptation is coming back to the Chicago Shakespeare Theater next season.
That's wonderful news.
Yeah, I'm so excited. It's this dance-forward musical that uses the music from the 2005 album, and it's really lovely. It premiered here, it went on to Broadway, and if folks missed it the first time around, I would definitely recommend
it. You had me at dance.
Yeah, the dance is really lovely. It's from Justin Peck, the award-winning New York-based choreographer. So
Tony Award-winning, right?
That's right, yeah. Tony Award-winning.
So, Matt, what other stories are you following?
Well, I am very interested. I know she was talking about it yesterday, but Ambar Cologne, she's got this story about this trend of venues in the city that are going phone free. There's a couple different ways that they can do it. There was one pop-up event where, you know, you had a DJ and people, they dropped their phones off in like essentially these like pouches. It's kind of like a coat check, right?
Yes.
And then, you know, you do this phone free experience where you're playing games, you're doing crafts, and the whole point is having this face forward interaction with people. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's also these pouches, which has become kind of common in some other places across the U.S.
I mean,
too.
It's kind of wild to me. Courtney, this is kind of right in your
phone
scene.
Phone free. I know. Phone get out free for a concert. Night out without your phone, connecting with people. It's interesting.
Yeah. And there's
would have thought.
There's that story. And then on Friday, I am meeting up with a country singer named Andrew Sa. He's kind of become known in the music scene basically for this Cosmic Country Showcase. He's got a new record coming out next month, and I'm going to talk with him about it and his experience there. It's very much, I'm interested in Midwestern country music, you know? It's something something uniquely Midwestern about it. It's kind of in that vein of Sufjan.
Yeah, he's a friend of the show.
Yeah, right.
So that'll be something to look forward to as well. Courtney, what do you want to tease?
Big music festival weekend. We're going to have lots of coverage. There's three music festivals this weekend. Wow. This is really sort of the kickoff of festival season. So
here
we're looking at that on multiple fronts. So lots of music to be heard around town this weekend.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.